Good morning. I'd also like to thank the organizers and the panel for inviting us. It's a fascinating group of talks, I think you'll agree, and certainly we're all kind of repeating themes throughout these three discussions that a lot of this comes down to careful analysis of risk and benefit. With that said, I was tasked to give the pro side of intervention for recurrent disease in the neck. And just to start, I have nothing to disclose. Just to start with some context, again, a similar theme is that while many of our patients have excellent outcomes with differentiated thyroid cancer, there are very high recurrence rates. And this is probably a chart that many of you have seen before, just looking at the long-term impact of initial surgical and medical therapy on patients with differentiated thyroid cancer. And what we see is that if we follow patients for 15, 20, 25, 30 years, about 30% will develop recurrence. We actually know that number can be lower in low-risk patients, and it can be up as high as 70% in patients that are high-risk. Of the recurrences, most of them are in the neck, and even of those that had distant metastases, half of them still have disease in the neck. So to talk about some of the options in terms of advocating intervention for recurrent disease, there are a couple of things that I think are important to consider. The first, what are the benefits of reoperation? Are we getting better at reoperation, meaning are we having fewer complications? And then what do patients think? Because again, that's going to be a critical component of what we decide. So what are the benefits of operative intervention for recurrent persistent cervical neck disease? Well, one of the first benefits is that operating on these recurrent structures are that they can be very close to and infiltrate neck structures. So in the central neck, of course, there's the recurrent laryngeal nerve, the parathyroid glands, and the esophagus. And the lateral neck, although it's considered in some cases more forgiving, there are also structures that can be locally invaded. We also know that in patients that in fact do have involvement of the recurrent laryngeal nerve with differentiated thyroid cancer, many of those cases are due to involvement of central lymph nodes. And this was an interesting study published from a Japanese endocrine unit where they looked at 629 patients with papillary thyroid cancer, and a small percentage, but a reasonable percentage, had recurrent laryngeal nerve invasion. 38 patients had recurrent laryngeal invasion by a lymph node, and 18 had invasion by primary tumor. And if you look here on the right, of the patients that had recurrent laryngeal nerve invasion, about a quarter of them, the invasion was actually from the lymph node, not from the primary tumor. And many of us have seen that in our practices. So lymph nodes are not always small, innocuous lesions, but rather they can actually be the structure that's invading the nerve. So one of the other reasons that operation can be an excellent form of treatment for recurrent disease is that reoperation can in fact lead to biochemical and structural remission. And there are a number of studies that have demonstrated this over the last decade. This is one that was published in 2011 from Korea. Basically, a retrospective study looked at 83 patients with recurrent and persistent papillary thyroid cancer, and they had a very stringent outcome of a biochemical remission, which was a stimulated thyroglobulin level of less than 1 nanogram per milliliter. And this chart here shows us the thyroglobulin levels before and after reoperation. And on this panel, these were 70 patients that had no evidence of recurrent disease, and these were 13 patients that had recurrent disease. And what essentially they saw is that you had biochemical remission. Again, this is undetectable thyroglobulin stimulated thyroglobulin of 51% in patients that underwent reoperation. Patients with stimulated thyroglobulin levels over 5 nanograms per milliliter had a higher chance of second recurrence, which is not surprising. So this is another study with similar findings from France that looked at 161 patients with recurrent persistent papillary thyroid cancer. This study used a slightly less stringent definition of a complete response in that this was basal thyroglobulin levels less than 1 nanogram per milliliter with normal imaging. And essentially what they found at their first outpoint or their first study at 7 months was that there was a 63% complete response rate, 10% had persistent structural disease, 10% had biochemical incomplete response, and 17 had an intermediate response. And when they looked at their last assessment after reoperation at 5 years, 62% of patients still maintained a complete response. Again, undetectable thyroglobulin levels. So this is a comparison of outcomes to reoperation for recurrent differentiated thyroid cancer. So these are about 10 studies, again, over many years. And when you combine the information from these studies, we see that while 30 to 50% of people have unmeasurable thyroglobulin levels after reoperation, that the thyroglobulin levels do drop dramatically when compartment-based dissection is done. And the results are even better when you just look at structural disease. There's about over 80% clearance. So the second question is, are we getting better at reoperations? And this kind of touches on what Dr. Wong was talking about with the central neck and the lateral neck, especially in reoperative settings, being associated with higher risk of injury. So I actually included the same compilation of studies, but with a different conclusion, which is that in expert hands, if you really look at these data, the results in terms of unexpected nerve injury and permanent hypoparathyroidism are actually approaching or even comparable to first-time central neck dissection. Remember, Dr. Sipple's talk quoted 3 to 50% injury rate. So, you know, these results, while not insignificant, are, again, approaching or comparable to what we see in first-time central neck dissection. So the reason that perhaps these results are getting better, especially in some of the newer, the more contemporary studies, is that there have been refinements, there have been evolution in our surgical technique, and some of those I think have had a real impact on our complication rates. The first big change in the last decade has been, I think, more global and routine use of recurrent laryngeal nerve monitoring, especially for reoperative cases. There are other techniques such as using the lateral approach where rather than beginning the dissection through the very scarred midline, we can use a technique where we kind of come down the medial aspect of the sternocleidomastoid muscle, identify the carotid and internal jugular vein early, get an early vagal signal, and really identify the nerve early, and that can help us a great deal. There are also a number of focus techniques. So these are techniques that we use in compartments that have already been entered or dissected. And those vary in the literature, radio-guided, needle localization, methylene blue techniques, and then the injection of carbon nanoparticles. Here's just an example of one of those techniques that I think has helped us really decrease our dissection and complication rates. And this is just using intraoperative ultrasound-guided methylene blue dye localization. This can be especially helpful when you're trying to make sure that you're matching the node that you've biopsied with the one that you remove, and has led to really excellent results. This was reported by Dr. Shen, one of my colleagues, in 2010. And we looked at 189 initial central lymph node dissections, compared it with 106 reoperative. And the take-home message here is that the neck hematoma, transient hoarseness, permanent hoarseness, permanent hypoparathyroidism, those were all comparable between the reoperative and the initial operative group. The only difference was in transient hypocalcemia, which was in fact higher with the initial surgery than the reoperative surgery. This is just a similar paper using a different technique of preoperative localization, this time with carbon nanoparticles. Again, finding that the rates of injury, the rates of hypoparathyroidism were comparable in the two groups, and transient hypocalcemia, again, in this study was actually higher in the control group. So to answer that question, I think we are doing a bit better. So thirdly, what do our patients think? And this, I think we've heard in a few of the previous talks that patients have very real concerns about some of our very advanced observational strategies. This was a direct quote from one of my patients who came essentially across the country for a second opinion, and her opening line to me was, she went to this major cancer center, they told her my cancer is back and we're going to watch it. And while in my mind I was coming up with the same recommendation, I realized how patients are framing this question. So cancer is a very powerful word. Recurrence can trigger quite a bit of anxiety, emotional distress, and as we've seen, this can affect quality of life. And again, this pervasive culture of kind of fighting cancer is a little bit at odds with what's happening in thyroid cancer, where we are really advocating a very different philosophy. So finally, what does the American Thyroid Association say for the optimal approach to patients with suspected structural neck recurrence? The recommendation 71 is that therapeutic compartment, central and or lateral neck dissection in a previously operated compartment, sparing uninvolved vital structures, should be performed for patients with biopsy-proven persistent or recurrent disease over 8 millimeters and in the central neck and over 10 millimeters in the smallest dimension in the lateral neck. This is a strong recommendation with moderate quality evidence. They go on to state that surgical resection generally represents the optimum treatment of macroscopic gross nodal disease, which is probably why most of the folks in the audience raised their hand in terms of operating on this, on our case. So in conclusion, we know that recurrence is very common. It can lead to local invasion. It can cause significant anxiety and distress for patients and endocrinologists and surgeons. I do think that in experienced hands, while the complication rates are real, a reoperation can be done with comparable complication rates. And it can result in durable biochemical and even better structural responses. In reality, I think for individual patients, such as the one that was presented, we're going to need to do a more careful risk-benefit analysis, probably taking into account the biology and what we know about the biology, the motivation and expertise of the care team and who's going to follow patients, and then also a real consideration of the patient and their motivation and their emotional concerns. So again, multidisciplinary teams and careful focus on a risk-benefit analysis. Thank you.
So we have about 10 minutes left, and because there were so many questions about our first case discussion, also where we were talking about the debate between lobectomy, total thyroidectomy, and active surveillance, I would also like to open the floor up for questions related to that as well. But first, I'd like to poll the audience. Has anyone had their mind sort of readjusted and changed based on the discussion we just heard about persistent and recurrent disease? Yeah. I think that's true. So, Dr. Wong, any thoughts from you to open that up about whether your mind?
I think Jessica gave a really nice talk, and I think the conventional wisdom is if it's there, you take it out. The patient was treated and it's back again. That's what the patient thinks. That's what most people think. But, you know, the statistics that Luke shared are really compelling. You have to remember that it's so rare for people to die from this disease. And when people die from thyroid cancer, it's such a different disease. And, you know, I do a lot of revision surgery. I do like to clear people out, but for me, it's a multifactorial decision. I look at age of patient. I look at comorbidities, size, location, differentiation, and personal characteristics, like Jess is saying, how did the patient feel about it? And I integrate all these variables together, and I wind up with a decision based on all these variables, because it's complicated, and it's not easy to say everyone should have this and everyone should not have this. So you have to really tailor and be selective in how you decide to do your revision surgery.
Wouldn't you agree, though, it's also the time factor? And we have seen, and that was 10 years, we have a cadence of their disease that's very different than the one that's 18 months out, and they're now showing disease. So that's persistent. But, you know, in this patient, I'd say that cancer has been there for 10 years, and you've been fine for 10 years.
Exactly. It's the tempo.
The time course is
right. Then the whole idea of this assessment of dynamic change is what we're doing also with our active surveillance program. So for the patients that Luke and Mike are following that have these micropapillary cancers, what they're doing is they're measuring the change in volume over time, and they're getting like these delta graphs. And for the patients that are having a delta, even if they're still small, but if the delta is really steep, we're kind of moving them towards surgery, even if it's still in intrathyroidal, whereas the people that have really flat and no change, those are the patients we're more and more comfortable with. I think it's the biology really trumps a lot of the other measures.
What I learned today is that despite we're talking about the usual, the easy papillary thyroid carcinoma, 30% of the patients will come to this stage. So what I learned is that I have to warn them in advance, not continue the usual theme, oh, this is nothing, you are lucky, we have a non-cancerous cancer, and so forth, because we will face 30% of our patients coming back, and then they will be disappointed. So we do have to warn them, and the quality of life will be better if we do are honest from the beginning, so to avoid this sort of a problem. Yes.
The back microphone was first.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Hi. Jacob Wallum from Rochester, New York. Congratulations on an unbelievable panel and great presentations all through. I have a couple of questions regarding a specific slide that Dr. Morris showed. This related back to the ATA document. And correct me if I'm wrong, you referred to this as the standard of care, where in fact these are actually recommendations. They're not guidelines, and they're certainly not standards of care. But the other point that I'd like to make about that slide was that in recommendation 35, which is where this was paraphrased from, the ATA specifically talks about thyroid nodules that are less than 1 centimeter in size, which could be managed with no surgery versus lobectomy. And the case presented was a 14 millimeter thyroid nodule, so I'm concerned about applying that guideline or that recommendation to that patient.
So these are only guidelines. These are meant to represent what a ecumenical group of people felt in 2014 was the state of the art. The evidence is compelling enough that before these guidelines, we felt that active surveillance was acceptable within the standard of care. So Dr. Pasika mentioned three options. I think all of them are defensible within the standard of care. There is no single standard of care for any patient. Now, active surveillance by the ATA guidelines, if you do read this like the Bible, which you don't have to, and I don't, it doesn't say it has to be microcarcinoma. They simply say very low risk disease. And very low risk disease may be bigger than a centimeter. There's no magic that occurs. BRAF doesn't get turned on at 1.1 centimeters. So this is really your judgment as to what is a low risk tumor. For example, a papillary microcarcinoma. I underlined the EG. They didn't, but I underlined it. That's my emphasis. It doesn't have to be a microcarcinoma. A small papillary thyroid cancer confined within the thyroid gland without extrathyroidal extension, without any lymph node involvement. Is a reasonable case to consider active surveillance, and in most of those patients, it's going to be very low risk disease.
Juan Paramo from Miami. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. Thank you for making a very confusing subject even more confusing. I wonder, in patients that have recurrent disease, how do all of you use the thyroglobulin levels and the biochemical portion of it to make a judgment of what should be done? Thank you.
We can start from the end.
Yeah, I think it's very important. You know, there's a lot of data looking at thyroglobulin doubling time as a predictor, as a prognostic factor, and also as a measure of tumor burden if your disease is known to be a thyroglobulin producing disease. So we use it quite regularly, and we estimate thyroglobulin doubling times. Now, that in itself doesn't always perfectly correlate with structural disease. So I do separate in my mind the TG from structural disease when I'm deciding about surgery. I never operate on a TG, I operate on a lesion. But the TG definitely gives you a sense of urgency, and it gives, as Janice was saying, like it gives you an idea of trends in biological activity. If you see the TG rising at a steep rate, it kind of gives you a little more urgency that you wanna get that disease out as much as you can ASAP.
Yes, I agree with those comments. I think also similar to calcitonin for medullary, it can kind of give you an idea, or not perfectly, but if you think that disease is confined to the neck versus metastatic. So I think you can use it to help gauge that as well.
I would say the limitation of using TG is that if your cancer has transformed into something that's not well differentiated anymore, then your TG may remain low, but they have a lot of disease. And I echo Dr. Wong's comments about trying to disconnect the biochemical recurrence from a structural recurrence. And I think that's a very important parameter to consider.
You know, I think I struggle with this because I think we talk about this as recurrence, but we all realize almost all of this is persistence, right? This was disease that was there. We're just recognizing it in a delayed fashion. So I struggle with the decision about trying to be more aggressive up front to get more people to that optimal outcome. You know, I just think if we could do the right surgery up front and everybody would have an undetectable thyroglobulin, we could probably just tell patients, go live your life. You're going to be fine and never even need follow-up, versus sort of, you know, having this persistence. Consistently elevated thyroglobulin that then just is this continual follow-up. If I think about the patients that are referred to me that persistently elevated thyroglobulin, the number of ultrasounds, biopsies, appointments, and the chronic anxiety and fear of recurrence of that uncertainty is really miserable for patients. So, you know, I think the key is if we're going to accept this and have these persistently elevated levels, how we communicate to patients what that means and convince them that it's okay to do nothing and to follow that. But I think that that's the hardest part about this, is that the long-term management for these patients.
Final question before we have the final statement by Dr. Davis.
Go ahead. My question is for Dr. Morris. You mentioned that you have 300 patients in the active surveillance program. How many patients did it take for you to convince 300 people to stay with the program, and what's the compliance?
When we started this program, we thought we would be lucky if we could mirror the experience with active surveillance for prostate cancer, and the uptake for that is about 25% in New York. We found that the uptake is probably about 85%. We didn't think patients would accept it the way that they have. Honestly, patients read your every facial expression when they're in the room with you. Establishing a rapport with them is critical to what we do as surgeons, explaining a diagnosis to them. And if you are not worried, they won't be worried. And if you tell them, it's not that I don't want to see you again, it's that now is not yet the time for your surgery, people generally are very enthusiastic. Not everybody, but it's about 80-85% want to go for active surveillance. The compliance probably is a little higher at our center. We have probably slightly more motivated patients because we're not a county hospital. And I agree that is an advantage. And you have to modify this program to your setting, but I wouldn't worry that just because your patient's going to be lost to follow-up with a small PTC for some number of years that it's It's not appropriate to, that you should deny them the option. Just talk about all the options with your patient as honestly as you can.
Thank you, Dr. Davis.
I'll just come up to the front. Just a few outgoing thoughts as we're finishing up here. So in that debate about active surveillance versus lobectomy and total thyroidectomy, what I heard and we reflected here is that there actually are these three reasonable options, but if you're going to think about active surveillance, you need friends. You need multidisciplinary friends like endocrinologists. In the central neck, we heard these great messages to understand more about microscopic versus macroscopic disease and the importance of that. And then finally, in the issue of metastatic and persistent disease, monitoring has a place, and it's a specialized skill set, but you can go back in if you need to. Let's give a round of applause to our panel. They're amazing. Thank you so much. And we'll stay here at the end for any questions if you want to come up for further discussion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all. Have a nice day.